Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and time for the Week in Review.
She cannot garner the confidence of the public or of her line staff.
On Monday, Governor Deval Patrick accepted the resignation of Commissioner Olga Roche of the Department of Children and Families following the deaths of three children. And six Massachusetts colleges and universities are facing a federal investigation for their handling of sexual harassment cases on campus. Vice President Joe Biden said Tuesday that it's a nationwide problem.
We know the numbers. One in five of every one of those young women who's dropped off that first day of school before they finish school will be assaulted.
And on Wednesday, Northern Irish police arrested Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams based on evidence they gathered from a Boston College oral history project that may implicate Adams in a decades-old killing. But one academic who made the recordings sees a longer play.
So I see this very much as a ploy by Gerry Adams to get this monkey off his back.
And just yesterday, Boston firefighters agreed to a new contract. So joining me now to talk about these stories in our Week in Review panel is Peter Canellos, editorial page editor at the Boston Globe. How do you do, Peter?
Fine, thank you, Meghna.
Happy Friday to you.
Thank you.
Also with us today is Tom Keene. He's a former city councilor and regular columnist for the Globe. Tom, great to see you at the table for the first time.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start off with some less than delightful news, far less than delightful news, and that is the latest this week from the Department of Children and Families. It was the, of course, resignation of Commissioner Olga Roche from DCF. Governor Deval Patrick seemed reluctant to accept her resignation. He said he did so with sadness, but he also acknowledged that Roche had actually lost the faith of her staff and of state legislators.
We knew the time was coming. We were waiting and hoping to get through the implementation of these reforms before making a change. But it's clear to me, clear to the secretary, and clear to the commissioner that we're not going to be able to get those reforms, the focus of the agency, as long as she remains in charge.
And now that Roche has resigned, lawmakers like Senate Minority Leader Bruce Tarr says, as to those reforms, they want results quickly.
The one thing that needs to happen immediately is to have a tracking system that leaves no room for error, that makes sure that home visits are tracked, if they aren't made, that that's documented and something is done about it, and that every child has their whereabouts known.
So, Peter, let me turn to you first on this. What do you make of the handling of Roche's resignation and what it means for these reforms that we were just hearing about at DCF?
Well, Governor Patrick basically stuck with her as long as possible, and it actually is a little, unusual for him to not handle something in a very crisp way when there's a crisis. But he didn't. He delayed a while, and I think she did become sort of a lightning rod. And she was implementing a very, very aggressive system of tracking kids, but there was an air of panic about it. So I think that making the change now makes sense, and hopefully the reforms will be going more smoothly in the future.
So we'll talk about the reforms a little bit more in a moment, but Tom, let me turn to you. It seemed, as Peter said, that all the way up until just Monday, when both Senate President Therese Murray and House Speaker Robert DeLeo both came out and said they demanded Roche's resignation, that indeed the governor was standing behind her.
Completely. And he was resisting. And I mean, the kind of tendency we all have in something like this, which is we want someone's head when there's a disaster. Quite frankly, I'm not sure the commissioner is at fault in this one, but quite clearly this was a circumstance where you had to have her resign or removed in order to be able to start addressing the issues.
Okay, so does this then clear the political air to address those issues and to start the reforms?
It clears the political air. It does not clear the substantive air.
Okay, so tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, because I honestly don't think that the problem with DCF happens to be this particular commissioner. DCF is kind of like the third rail of the state bureaucracy. She's certainly not the first commissioner to get in trouble with it. Harry Spence, if you remember, prior to this. And this is a real problem we have with this agency. Now, we can politically clear it, put in some reforms. Maybe those are going to have an effect or maybe not. It'll be interesting to see some of the new ones that are just being proposed today by the child advocate. But I'm not sure that this solves any problem without those reforms in place.
So, Peter, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, indeed, the problems at DCF are both structural and organizational and possibly even cultural. I mean, a long-term solution is long in coming, but at least we have, you know, people talking about technology and tracking systems and things like that, which have to get the department somewhere moving forward.
Yeah, I think that it's a complicated problem, and I agree with much of what Tom said, but not all of what Tom said. I think that, you know, there's a damned if you do, damned if you don't problem when you're removing children from homes. And sometimes kids do not do well in foster care, and breaking up families is utterly the wrong thing to do. And there are complaints about various ways in which parents get mischaracterized or misidentified as being neglectful. On the other hand, if you bend over backwards to maintain families, which seems to be more in the current policy, there's the possibility that kids will die of abuse and neglect. And it's a little bit of a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of question. That's standard. But what we've seen in the last couple of months is just incompetent mistakes, losing track of children.
Right.
You know, a fax gets misplaced, and so there's no supervision for a child. That's not a sign of these deep, endemic, long-term problems. This is more of a short-term kind of, they really screwed up in two cases, and they need to tighten up their procedures, and that's why having a new boss might actually help. So,
Well, obviously, there's much more to be discussed about DCF as Interim Commissioner Erin Devaney has a chance to make her mark on the department, and we'll be, of course, following that story as time goes by. But let's move on to another major issue this week that popped up on the news radar screen, and that is the fact that the U.S. Department of Education just this week released a list of more than 50 schools nationwide that are facing federal investigation due to their handling of harassment and sexual assault cases on campus. And therefore, they are also facing federal investigations in terms of possible Title IX violations. Now, the list of Bay State schools is long and distinguished. It includes Harvard, Boston University, Emerson, Amherst College, and UMass Amherst as well. Also around the rest of New England, Dartmouth makes the list. So does UConn. Now, one of the cases that prompted this was that of Sarah Tedesco. She said she was raped 2 years ago during her freshman year at Emerson College, and that at the time, the school did not do enough to help her.
You go and you report it to an administrator, and they victim blame you. And they you know, they ask you, what were you wearing? Why were you at an off-campus party? It's like, I'm here trying to come forward. I want you to be a little bit more compassionate with me. Guide me through this process.
Tom, I want to turn to you first, because obviously the issue of sexual assault on campus has been around for a very long time. But what do you make of the fact that the Department of Education is now saying, hey, look, you might be in violation of Title IX, which then carries pretty severe penalties, including federal funding?
Right. And it's an interesting list, because it appears that the schools that are on the list kind of fall into three categories. Those where there's some real suspicion they are not in compliance with sexual harassment and assault laws. Those that there have been a complaint about, but it's been unverified as to whether there's a problem. And then those apparently that are just mere compliance checks.
Right.
So what I can't figure out about this list is this being done, does it mean anything even that we have such a big list? Or is it just a political statement on the part of the administration trying to raise kind of the level of attention that's being given to this issue? And if you listen to Vice President Joe Biden, it certainly seems that that might be part of it.
And this is happening in the very same week that the White House's panel on sexual assault on campus had released its findings or its preliminary report. Peter, your first response to this new list from the Department of Education.
Yeah, I think there's a political motive here in terms of, the administration wanting to tout its protection of women. You know, we're getting into another campaign season right now, and it's no question they want to motivate the base in the Democratic Party. On the other hand, I think there's some evidence that universities haven't been consistent or clear in terms of setting sexual abuse guidelines. One of the issues that Harvard is wrestling with right now is they don't require that there's mutual consent, explicit consent for sex. And so they get caught in a lot of ambiguous situations where people sometimes are too afraid to say no, but get assaulted anyway, and they can't punish that situation. So I think it's actually a public good to try to have some sense of uniform standards. It's almost part of the educational mission of these schools. You know, it should be clear and express consent before anybody has sex, that's a good lesson to teach kids.
Mm. So, Tom, let me turn back to you, because I take your point about the fact that there's one must always question the political motivation and timing. But on the other hand, why not use the political levers at your disposal at the federal level to really address a nationwide problem? I mean, when, as Vice President Biden said, one in five young women entering college will be assaulted. And, you know, let's be honest, a great number of young men as well, it happens to them too. You know, why not use things like the threat of a Title IX violation to do something to take a chunk, a bite out of the problem at least?
Right. So, but look at the way that this list has been read, okay? The way this list has played out is, oh, these are schools where there is a problem. That doesn't actually, that's not necessarily the case with this list. This list may just be a pure compliance check. It may be a complaint where that may or may not indicate that there's a real problem. That's kind of the political aspect I was referring to, and I think that Peter was referring to,
okay,
sort of using these schools as kind of manipulating the schools by saying, oh, look how widespread the problem is, because we have a list of 50 schools. We don't know that all 50 schools are really in trouble.
And we already knew that the problem is widespread. Peter,
right,
just to bring another school into the fold here, because the Globe just reported this week, I believe, on the fact that Tufts University is pushing back on allegations from the Office of Civil Rights that it has mishandled several sexual assault cases on campus. And even this is after an agreement that Tufts reached with the Federal Office of Civil Rights here, too. So that's one case in which we actually have a university pushing back, saying, look, we have acknowledged that there's a problem, we're working on something, but you can't actually say that we're not doing enough.
Well, and also, we were talking just before about the child protection issues. I mean, there are structural problems in dealing with sexual assaults on campus. This is rape is a notoriously difficult crime to prove. And I certainly sense the anger and sense the fact that it's a serious crisis out there. But it's a difficult one to attack, because the whole consent issue can become very ambiguous. That's why we need to have very, very clear guidelines at these universities, and they need to implement them in a way that's consistent with federal law.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, let's move on, if we can, to yet another story. This connects Boston and Ireland, not exactly a new connection, but it's a new angle on the long history between Boston and Ireland. And that's because this week, Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams was arrested in connection with a 1972 Belfast murder that was allegedly committed by the Irish Republican Army. And the arrest comes after the release, and we should say under court order, of oral histories done under the auspices of Boston College about the Troubles in Northern Ireland, as they're called. Here's Anthony McIntyre. He appeared on our show yesterday. He's a former member of the IRA. He left the organization after the 1998 Good Friday Agreement, and he conducted many of the interviews in Boston College's Oral History Belfast Project.
I'm deeply disappointed and angry at the arrest of Mr. Adams. I think there's a large political motivation here on the part of the PSNI. The day prior to Mr. Adams' arrest, the British state turned down a demand for an inquiry into British Army behaviour in Ballymurphy, the neighbourhood Mr. Adams grew up in and lived in at the time of the massacre in 1971.
So all of this comes as the run-up to elections, comes in the run-up to elections in Ireland, I should say, where Sinn Féin may make some fairly big gains. So Peter, it's a complicated story that links academics and history and the peace process in Ireland all together. So let's get your take on this.
Well, I think that a truth or reconciliation process, a really rigorous one, would have solved a lot of these lingering issues if all the parties had agreed to it and there was a push for it 20 years ago. It's not helpful to the situation in Northern Ireland right now to have interviews like the one that you just broadcast, where people are suggesting that the authorities are prosecuting IRA criminals, but they're not prosecuting loyalists. And, it risks reviving a lot of the same sectional bad feelings. So it is a difficult situation, it probably could have been handled on a different level, as we've seen in places like South Africa, when peace comes, there should also be a reconciliation process.
Right. And to your point, I mean, as evidenced this week, a lot of those bad feelings don't take much to come right back to the surface because they are still very there and very alive for the people who lived through all this. I mean, we also heard some tape on our show earlier this week from the son of Jean McConville, the woman who was killed back in the 1970s, who says he's still in fear for his life about what the repercussions would be if indeed Jerry Adams ends up being prosecuted for this crime that he's now under arrest for. Tom, your take.
So these allegations have dogged Adams for a long, long time. I found it fascinating, one of the suggestions on one of the tapes he played from a speaker, that perhaps he actually wants this to be addressed, that in fact he wants to get this particular monkey off of his back, which may really be part of what's going on here. But I fully agree with Peter that, you know, it would have been great to have a reconciliation process, but we didn't have one. So now the question is, how do you deal with situations like this, where this was clearly a very real crime, a horrific murder that went on, and the family is demanding some level of justice? I mean, I don't think it's enough to say, well, we're not going to give them justice unless everybody else who's out there as a particular allegation of some problem out there also gets the same measure of justice. Here's a very prominent case featuring a very, very prominent individual. I don't know how you can't go after him in this.
Yeah,
well, but Tom is saying two different things there, though. He's saying, in one sense, this is a very prominent case, very prominent individual, so you have to go after them. But you're also saying, how can we not do this when it's every murder, every family deserves justice? And so every family and every murder does deserve justice. But the question here is whether Jerry Adams is being targeted because he happens to be a major leader, because he was a subject of this oral history project, because maybe he wants to clear his name or whatever.
But Peter, that's exactly right.
Political gloss there.
That's exactly right. He probably is because of how prominent he is. Just as, by the way, that in the United States, we go after and we certainly pay far more attention to people who are celebrities, okay? Take the case of Donald Sterling and his remarks as an owner of a basketball team. Someone else who's a racist in a different circumstance doesn't get anywhere near the attention. Yes, prominent people do get attention. People who are in power do get attention on things like this, and they should.
And he's
from the media, but not from prosecutors, supposedly. I mean, be prosecuting all murders equally, right?
But if I may just make the point, on the other hand, I mean, Jerry Adams, regardless of the side that one finds themselves on in the Irish conflict, has been under scrutiny from British authorities for decades. I mean, he was even banned from having his voice heard on British media during the Thatcher administration. So it's not as if this is new attention on him.
Yeah, it's true. But he also was a positive figure in the peace process, too. So it's a complicated situation.
It is a complicated situation. Yeah. But the fact that he is a target here because he is prominent.
All right. Well, on that point, we have just enough time to lighten the mood a little bit, gentlemen, if we can, because we've got a couple minutes to share with everyone our hubbubs. And those are the stories that maybe didn't make it to the top of our story list this week, but still deserve a mention. So, Peter, I'm ready to hear yours. Come on.
A beloved hardware store closed in the Bowdoin-Geneva neighborhood of Boston, Hamilton Hardware, about a week and a half ago. It finally closed its doors. And it's a familiar story in a lot of ways, of the mom-and-pop operation that's put out of business by big-box stores. But in this case, hardware stores have a unique mission in urban communities, especially when you're dealing with a lot of old houses and things like that. You know, the person who knows precisely what washer to put on a particular screw, and, there's a point of connection in community. So it's especially unfortunate when one goes like that. And in a very real sense, you can measure urban health by how many local hardware stores there are in the neighborhood.
Absolutely. It's sad to see that one go. Tom, your hubbub?
So a New Jersey bar owner who loves the Yankees and hates the Red Sox decided to open up a brand new bar in New Brunswick, New Jersey, called, be careful about how you say this, Buck Foston's. And I'll allow the listeners to figure out what he really meant by that. The mayor of that city, who happens to be an ardent Red Sox fan, put a stop to that bar opening. The bar owner, in turn, sued the city and actually ended up winning a $1.5 million judgment. Now, I have to tell you, the money notwithstanding, I think I'm in sympathy with the mayor of New Brunswick. And it's not only because I happen to be a Red Sox fan, but also because I think I kind of respect a mayor who says, I want to stop the coarsening and I want to make this a more civilized place. And if there's any place that needs to be less coarse and more civilized, it's New Jersey.
I wasn't sure where you were going to go with that. And my goodness, you did lead us down a great road. That's a conversation for another day, Tom. All right. Well, my hubbub. I do a lot of science hubbubs, but this one I'm going to give credit to our producer, Alex Kingsbury, for finding, because at Harvard there were a bunch of researchers who were trying to fabricate new kind of springs to mimic shapes that they see in nature, and they were playing with rubber bands, and they actually ended up creating a helix, or what they call a hemihelix, I should say, that's a shape that's almost never seen in nature. But it turns out that people who study these structures know that they're incredibly useful and could be used for creating new nano devices, new sensors, electromagnetic wave absorbers, I'm seeing. But it's just it's a shape that now that they've made basically by accident with rubber bands, they could use to develop a whole, you know, brand new set of technologies. So kids out there who are playing with rubber bands, you never know what might happen. So more fun from the world of science. That is my hubbub for today. And let me just say, Tom Keene, former city councilor and columnist for the Boston Globe, great to have you at the table. Thanks so much for joining us. And Peter Canellis, editorial page editor at the Globe as well. Happy Friday to you, Peter. Thanks so much.
Happy Friday, Magna.
Thank you.
Well, listeners, stick with us, because up next we'll talk to Worcester native and comedian H. John Benjamin. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.